Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Sir Chad Artifact Riley.
Tally-ho, good friend.
Was that like an Indiana Jones kind of thing?
I don't know. You called me an artifact, and I don't know. I don't know what an artifact says.
Well, maybe our other host may know, Mr. Spencer Williams.
I don't know what an artifact says. They don't generally speak or are people.
Are people?
True. Are.
You guys both are just too much.
Awesome.
But what's great is that we are not alone. We have a fourth guest here with us today. That is Mr. David Webb, host of Video Game Bang.
What's going on, everybody?
What's up, Kevin?
I also don't know what Artifact says, and I agree with Spencer. I don't think they talk.
Artifact says, what?
You guys are all... I'm leaving. You guys aren't even... No. We got a great show in store for you, as we're going to be talking about the recent video game film called Tomb Raider. So stick around as we get into a little bit of that. But before we do, Chad has a little bit of info for you.
I do. Like a medieval puzzle box you can never quite figure out, the Filmlosophers podcast is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each week at VGB Studios. Whether life takes you across the sea or keeps you comfortably at home, you can access the podcast wherever you find an internet connection. New episodes debut each Wednesday on Libsyn, Stitcher, Audioboom, Player FM, iTunes, and Google Play. Spencer, where else can they find us?
In spite of your best intentions, do you find yourself easily misunderstood all too often? Well, we moonlight as psychiatrists, so you can join the conversation on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101.
Little disclaimer, we don't moonlight as psychiatrists, just so everybody knows.
I do.
Current and previous episodes are available on demand on our website. So it's Facebook. It's filmlosophers.com.
There you go. We got a website, which the website leads to all our wonderful episodes where you can catch all of them all the time, any day of the week. But like I said, we do have a great show in store for you, as we will be talking about Tomb Raider. The only person, honestly, though, at this table that really has any inkling about any history of this, honestly, was Chad before we got into anyone else.
I know we were trying to really dig deep with that one.
We were desperate for help, so we had to pull in an expert, and that expert was Mr. David Webb.
So happy to be here. It's gonna be good.
Isn't it great that we have access to like such great knowledge, and it's like literally just a podcast away? We can just be like, hey, David, why don't you come over?
Just a podcast away.
It's like we're neighbors, and you come over to borrow a cup of sugar.
Exactly.
Hey, can I borrow a cup of knowledge?
Borrow a cup of knowledge?
It feels like Mr. Rogers' neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's
we just came in, we changed our shoes.
Studios.
And there you go.
Put on sweaters.
That's right. Rocking the sweaters.
So like I said, this movie has been making a lot of attention this past weekend. It debuted. A lot of mixed reviews, to be honest. I mean, there's people all over the place in terms of how this film actually panned out. Some people really liked it. Some people didn't. And the people that didn't weren't too kind at all. But
Well, you know, haters gonna.
But we actually all, most of us actually all saw it together. And we had a pretty decent experience. And we're probably going to talk about a lot of that. And maybe some of the stuff that one of the persons who didn't see it with us will tell us about how he thought, Mr. Spencer.
It was me. I didn't see it with everyone else.
But you did see it, so...
Yes, I did.
Moving on.
So, Chad, why don't you hit us with that synopsis?
I'd love to. Laura Croft is the fiercely independent daughter of an eccentric adventurer who vanished years earlier. Hoping to solve the mystery of her father's disappearance, Croft embarks on a perilous journey to his last known destination, a fabled tomb on a mythical island that might be somewhere off the coast of Japan. The stakes couldn't be higher, as Laura must rely on her sharp mind, blind faith, and stubborn spirit to venture into the unknown.
That's right. It works really well with the music when
I know,
you can hear
the
it.
The music
right?
really got a vibe going for me. I liked it. Give me something else to read. No, I'm kidding. Don't.
Yeah. Adapted from the iconic video game franchise, the film is directed by Roar Uthog and stars the young and talented Alicia Vikander, Walton Goggins, Dominic West, and Daniel Wu. Quick note about this film. In March 2013, MGM actually announced that they acquired the rights to this video game franchise from Paramount, who had actually, if you're unaware of, created two prior films before this of the same franchise. And unfortunately, 2003's Lara Croft Tomb Raider, The Cradle of Life, failed to find, you know, an audience within, you know, that spectrum. So they decided to just
Although some of us did mistakenly still put our butts in those seats and watch that movie. They didn't find an audience, but some of us did actually see it.
So I think one of the first things to kind of talk about when it comes to this this film is the fact that there is a substantial stigma when it comes to creating a video game film.
Adaptation,
yeah. Which we talked about adaptations in the last episode. If you listen to Lesson 104, there we talked about A Wrinkle in Time and how the novels get adapted into film and whatnot. So if you want to catch a lot of that conversation, head over to Lesson 104 and you can catch all that info. But in today's lesson, if you will, we're going to be talking about how video games don't usually translate well to
film. Yeah, they get
film.
A really bad rap usually, and deservedly so.
Yeah, like almost, there's not even like a really great one you can point to and be like, yeah, that was fantastic, except for like Wreck-It Ralph, which doesn't count because it's not based on anything.
Because there wasn't an actual source video game to start with.
Correct.
David, since you are the resident expert here, and I'm going to be calling you that quite a bit, so you can go home and tell Corey that we called you our resident video game expert.
I like the sound.
It's also the code word for we're going to let you talk 80% of the time in this episode. So thank you for doing our jobs for us.
Hey, that's what I'm here for.
So when it comes to video game movies, I know we've actually had this conversation several times off air about some of the things that, you know, usually become the pitfalls for most video game movies, whether if it's a lack of story or a lack of drive for future films or whatnot. What would you say, in your opinion, are some of the key things that really keep a video game film adaptation from really being successful?
I think it's all about how they approach it. You know, there's times when they're trying to make it as close to the game as possible, which you would think is a good thing, but there's times when it just doesn't translate, or being able to animate something is a lot different than actually making it come to life in a movie. And so you may have like being able to take what was animated and turn it into real life costs a lot more money than what the movie is budgeted for, so it kind of falls short. Changing the story too much, I think, is another thing that people can, you can, like, fall. Like, you fail at that.
Yeah.
It's just like, there's a variety of things.
Do you think the mechanics of the medium have anything to do with it? So, like, for example, if I were a gamer, which I'm not, everybody knows that I'm not.
We've talked about it at length on this podcast.
We have talked about it. But if I were a gamer, part of the appeal of a game, what makes it truly great is actually found in the act of playing through the levels.
Right.
Versus I'm sitting I'm viewing something on a screen. So even if I enjoyed the game, there was an interactive component to the game mechanic, right, versus just sitting in a seat eating popcorn.
And I think that has a good portion of it, and it's all kind of about how they shoot those scenes. And we can get more into that when you go into Tomb Raider, because there are specific scenes that I want to talk about in relation to the game. But yeah, I think that has a good, you know, a good part of it. It could end up looking more like a just extended cutscene of a game, mm-hmm, and it's not really, you don't have any investment in it like you do. You know, you're going into it expecting to have the same investment that you did with the game, and you just don't, for, you know, probably that reason.
Yeah. I think at this table, aside from David, the next person that I would say is pretty good at video games would be Mr. Williams over here, who happens to carry his Switch around most of the time when
it's
we see him.
It's in my bag right now.
It's in his bag right now. So to us, that qualifies as a consistent gamer. What about you, Spence? How do you feel in terms of, like, when you get a movie, when you get a video game movie, and, you know, what are some of the expectations when you're looking to see a successful video game? Like, what are you hoping to find when it comes to a good quality video game adaptation?
Okay, so maybe this is just my pessimism striking through, but I never expect that.
Well, there has just
been so much failure after failure in this, like, trying to do these adaptations that it never happens. So now I'm going into them. I'm like, well, maybe they can be okay, which is definitely possible. I really think that's a potential. Now, I think
the bar is really low.
Yeah, it's so low.
I'm just wanting them to be okay.
If you go in already disappointed, then you're not disappointed when you come out.
This is true, and that's probably why.
There you go.
But like, what I'm looking for is what you had to strike a fine balance of like changing it enough to fit like a movie, but then not changing too much of it to be foreign, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a very hard balance, and no one has got it right yet.
Well, like we said, we went to see the Tomb Raider film. It's not called Lara Croft. I'm still looking at the last note that I had. We went to go see Tomb Raider. All of us, we all had a chance to see it this past weekend. And I have to say, it was actually a decent film. It was actually a decent video game film from that perspective. But there's a lot of little things, like, you know, David and Spencer were saying, that really kind of get into the weeds about what makes it successful. What does a successful adaptation look like? What does have we ever seen one before this time? Have we ever seen anything that could remotely pass off, not just as a video game film, but just as a film, you know, all on its own? And we'll get into that. We'll touch into a little of that kind of stuff as we dive into the review. But first things first, I want to know, what are your guys' expectations, starting with Chad, when you knew we were going to go see it? We were at the theater. You, me, and Webb were all sitting at the, you know, in the aisle because Spencer didn't want to come and hang out with us.
Wow.
What were some of your expectations?
I was excited. I oddly enough, as a non-gamer, one of the only games that I have some exposure to is the original Tomb Raider. When my family purchased our first PC unit in the 90s, it came with like a sampler pack, a CD-ROM sampler pack, and it had on one of the discs, it had the first like tutorial levels of the first Tomb Raider game. And so I remember having played through those a few times because, well, we didn't buy the full game after that, but we played through the starter levels, and I loved it because, I mean, it's like a modernized female Indiana Jones kind of story. Which I grew up loving Indiana Jones. I'm from Indiana, so the fact that the character's name was Indiana, and he was cool, I mean, that was, you know, two positives.
That's like low-hanging fruit, though. Come on.
I mean, it was basically made for me to enjoy it, among other people, I'm sure. But yeah, so I've enjoyed the property the entire time that it's existed. I even did go to both of the Angelina Jolie films. I enjoyed the first one more than the second one, by far. You know, but I think that this film, going into it, we had the reboot of the game franchise in, what, 2013?
2013.
Yeah. So the game itself rebooted in a really cool way in 2013, was very well received, mostly. And the fact that they were basing this film adaptation reboot on that game reboot, I thought that was all, you know, green across the board. I'm a big fan of Alicia Vikander, and her presence on camera. She's not been in Hollywood for very long, but she's made a lot of films that I really enjoy.
Yeah.
I think I first saw her in The Man from U.N.C.L.E., and then I went back and saw Ex Machina after that. But she's incredible in both of those, and I've seen her in a couple things since. So, I remember when she started the training and was doing press junkets for Jason Bourne, and they were asking her, like, how hard is your training regimen, your diet and everything? And she said, yeah, actually, it's pretty rigorous, and it goes for a while before we even start filming. So I've been excited for a while, and nothing that I saw in the trailers gave me pause to say, oh, this is going to be another crummy video game adaptation that I'm going to hate having gone to. So I went in with, I guess, hope. That it was finally going to be a good video game movie.
What about you, David?
Pretty similar. It's one of my favorite video games. It's one of the first video games that I actually took the time to get 100% on. So, basically that going back and getting all of the side quests, all the achievements, everything I possibly could. And I did that after beating it just because I didn't want it to end. So to me, that's a mark of a really good game. So having said that, when I saw the previews and a lot of the scenes that they showed were very similar to sequences in the game, actually was cautiously optimistic going into this. That same thing, you know, this might be an actually good video game movie.
Spence?
Yeah, I'm going to roll off that. The trailers for this movie were actually pretty good, and I was like, I don't know. They've got quite a few elements that, like, I remember, like, some specific parts in that game that were just like that, and I'm like, well, we'll see. And, you know, they did a pretty good job. So I was, sitting there in the theater, kind of excited, kind of cautious, because I've already stated my opinions on that.
And same here. I think one of the biggest things for me is, when it comes to most films nowadays, everything seems to be adapted from some type of source material. And as I said, we stated this in the last episode, depending on how strong that source material is, you could either have a really successful film franchise on your hands, or you could have a really big dud. I mean, you know, they're making some really interesting movies nowadays. And with this particular franchise, my first concern was I was really hoping it wasn't just going to be another one of the ones that already came out through Paramount. Mind you, those were okay. They were entertaining, but I chalked those two up to like anything like with XXX or any of those other movies that are just visually stimulating but no content.
And it was very like of its time in terms of what was in vogue to show in an action movie. Not so much a video game adaptation, but an action movie at the time. They had those ridiculous sequences. I mean, you're right. It definitely was like XXX, Charlie's Angels, anything like that. That's what those Tomb Raider films kind of felt like.
So I think my biggest, like, I was going in with a little bit of hope in the thought that, okay, Alicia Vikander has been exceptional in everything that she's been doing. And I'm actually a fan of the actor Walton Goggins. I think he plays a really creepy guy, so for him to be the antagonist in this film made sense to me. I'm like, I'm naturally...
He looks creepy.
He does. He looks really
no
creepy.
No offense.
And so naturally seeing him in this type of role, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, I'll watch that. He's believable as a villain, even off-screen.
Absolutely.
So I would totally, you know, buy that in half. Yeah, my biggest concern, honestly, though, was the whole video game stigma. And that whole thing is that for the last, want to say what, 30 years, we have yet to have, no, maybe longer than that, we have yet to have a really substantial video game film. All the way from 1993's Super Mario Brothers. You know, that was a train wreck in itself. Spencer's already giving me the disgusting look.
No, I just didn't realize it was that recent. It was 93. I thought it was like 87 or something.
No,
it felt old.
1993.
It felt old when it came out.
And that was actually backed by Nintendo.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. Oof. But ever since that, I mean, we've yet to see a successful adaptation in the essence of, okay, this film, if you didn't know it was based on a video game, is an actual movie. This could stand alone as a movie by itself. You did,
right.
You know,
and
so.
You need that, I think. You've got to absolutely, you know, serve your existing fan base, which would be the people who've enjoyed the games. But if you're going to really succeed as a movie, you need something that succeeds as a movie.
By
it's
got
to pull in more than that fan base in order to really super qualify for, you know, being successful.
It's the same thing with the comic book movies.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
They're not super accurate to the comic books, but they stand alone. Somebody who does not read comic books at all can go see the Avengers, and they can get everything that's going on in there without having to know any of the backstory.
Yep,
that's really true. And that was one of the things with this particular franchise. Like, in my mind, I was hoping, okay, I really hope that I don't have to have beaten or at least gone through the whole game, the 2013 game, in order to grasp a lot of what is trying to be done in this film. And, you know, honestly, I don't game as much as I used to. And so seeing this game, I remember when it came out, but I don't remember ever having an interest in actually playing it. So immediately, as soon as we sat down, that was the first thought that came to my mind. I was like, ah, crud. I really hope I don't have to be like really going through my phone and Googling, all right, wait, what does this mean? Is that her like secret move or something? If you do this, this and that or something? So, needless to say,
her secret
Lovecraft's ultimate.
Her ultimate, exactly. Yeah. Fatality kind of thing. I don't know. So, and that goes back to, like I said, the stigma. I mean, most of the time, whenever you have any of these games, like one of the most successful ones out there, Street Fighter, 1996's. Mm-hmm.
That was successful?
No. I didn't say successful. I'm saying in terms of like that one particularly, it has a lot to do with its video game counterpart. I mean, you have to know most of that in order for you to understand this ridiculous story. Much like every other film that's come out since then. Like,
I was going
to
say Mortal Kombat.
Mortal Kombat, same thing. So, yeah, I think my biggest fear was that. The fact that we are never, I think the overwhelming fear was we are never going to get a successful video game adaptation.
I would say, and this is towing the line a little bit because I haven't played the games to know how they compare, but something like a couple of the films in the Resident Evil franchise, you know, it sometimes you forget, honestly, that it's a video game adaptation because it's also a horror action movie in its own right. Some of it sometimes actually works. I don't know that I would say across the board there's never been a video game adaptation that has worked. Maybe it hasn't satisfied everyone in the audience. But I think that there are a few, very few, bright spots, I guess, if you will, that kind of do live in the cinematic world on their own, separate from the video game they were pulled from, and they do it relatively successfully. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, that franchise went 7 movies?
Something like that. I think there's still one more that they're going to be doing.
Yeah, I think they've got some big brouhaha.
Wasn't the last one called like The Last Chapter or something? I don't know.
Which I don't think that, I think they've strayed from the game franchise because Resident Evil 7 is completely different. You're like kidnapped in like a house with some hillbilly crazy people.
Oh yeah, that was
trying
the
to
most,
escape.
That was and a I, recent one, wasn't it?
Right, and I can pretty much guarantee you that Resident Evil 7 movie has nothing to do.
Yeah,
with
it does
that.
Not.
It's just association by title alone.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, jumping into the movie, obviously, we got a chance to actually see it. And one of the things that you get an introduction to right away is you get an introduction to the young Lara Croft, the main character that everybody knows and loves from previous video game iterations. There's a unique, though, difference between this iteration and previous ones. And I think one of the things that stands out for me is that Alicia Vikander is such a stellar performer in her own right, in what she does and how she performs. And I think with this particular performance, one of the things to really highlight was the fact that she had a much more broad range of emotions as opposed to the previous iterations that we've seen before. It's been years since I've seen the last two films, but I know, Chad, you were talking about it in terms of it being a little bit more fresh than in my mind than in your mind than in mine.
In terms of the Angelina Jolie films?
Yes.
Most of what I remember are the things that I hated about them.
Oh, well.
I mean, to be honest. But, I think that there's something to be said for having a talented performer in a lead role, which I would say Alicia Vikander is, there, but also the pieces around that performer still need to be well calibrated, and it needs to be a good story, and you need to have other performers around you that are good at what they're doing, you know, to serve the story. And I think that she definitely did a great job embodying the personality traits that people have found appealing about Lara Croft for 2 decades. She did a great job with that, considering that, I mean, she would have been a toddler probably when the first game came out. She's almost as old. She's just a little bit older than the franchise itself. So I think there's something to be said there. But also the way that they constructed the story and the other players that they brought in terms of actors, I was really impressed with the caliber of the talent and the caliber of the story. I thought especially when you get into, and I'm sure we will in a few minutes, you know, more in depth, but the father-daughter relationship and how that is shown in different stages of her childhood and, you know, in the present day and all of that. I thought that that was exceptionally well done in ways that the earlier films didn't really even try. Because, you know, I mean, if you know the story, he's missing, he's out of her life. She lives in a mansion by herself and basically trains to be, I don't know, a ninja archaeologist. So, I mean, she just, he's not really a presence, except everything that she does is derives from the relationship that she had with her father and her desire to figure out what happened to him. And I think that in this film, they really leaned into that in a way that, I don't know, maybe they do, maybe they don't in the game. I haven't played, you know, the 2013 game, but I thought when you're working with movie mechanics, you've got to really make sure the audience understands a character's motives and that they're able to have some kind of an empathetic, sympathetic bond with the character that, you know, that you're, that is your protagonist. You've got to care about what happens to them and why they're doing what they're doing. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of explosions like a Michael Bay movie.
Exactly. David, one of the things, since you've actually completed the game, one of the things I've been wanting to ask somebody who actually knows, does the 2013 video game, is that like a reboot of the origin?
Yeah.
Okay, so 100%. Okay, so it does go through, like, a lot of what we saw in this film was a foundation maker, if you will, of the character Lara Croft in a brand new cinematic universe that they're doing. So it makes sense, then, that the game was also...
Right. I mean, the game starts about a quarter of the way, you know, into the movie. You know, the whole beginning of the movie, seeing her, you know, trying to make it on her own and being a bike messenger and seeing all that, it's... not even in the game at all. We start on the ship in the game.
Okay. And like Chad said, there's a lot of great performances in this film, including you have Dominique West. Dominique West plays her father, Richard Croft, whom I'm honestly not too sure if I remember seeing him in anything else. I'm pretty sure I have Dominique West, but
yeah, he's The Wire. Hello.
I don't remember offhand.
He's been in quite a few.
He's got one of those faces where, like, I know I've seen him probably, like, either in the background or something or playing something else, but I don't remember specifically the roles that he's played. But that's not to say that he didn't do a great job in this film, which he does. He does a stellar job in this movie as the father. And
he's in it a lot more than you expect. If you've been familiar with the franchise in whatever format before, you wouldn't expect to see as much of Richard Croft as you do in this film.
Spencer, what did you think about that father-daughter dynamic? Seeing as, like Chad said, with previous films, he's only been mentioned or kind of
the
focus.
He's like a hologram, isn't he? John Voight? Because it was like the whole weird, like Angelina Jolie is in real life John Voight's daughter. And then so he played, I believe, a hologram version or a video message version of himself.
Yeah, he was
with her. They weren't. Mm-hmm. They didn't share scenes,
right?
I think, like, literally, they filmed them separately because even though they're related, they have that same relationship in real life. They didn't get along at the time or something like that. I don't know.
Something. Yeah, he. Yeah, it was just flashback scenes in the movie, first movies, right?
I think so.
Yeah, just as like her as a kid.
Yeah.
But yeah, you don't see him at all in the other movies.
What was the first question? I'm sorry.
Your question was, no. What were your thoughts of seeing it in this dynamic? Seeing like
the father daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, I was actually kind of surprised because I was like, this is a legit plot line here.
Like, in a video game movie?
No.
What?
You have no idea how shocked I was during this. I'm like, okay, I'm feeling this really well because they really do play off each other, like, in a fantastic way, and it's a very believable relationship. And it's like what you said about, like, you have to buy, like, what they're trying to give you for their relationship, and I totally agree that they did, like, a great job with that. I was very impressed, actually.
And I have to admit, too, like I said, it was a great performance by the dad. Sadly, I don't know, for some reason, he always, I think he's, in my mind, a kind of a forgettable face, or he's got one of those faces where you see it and then you're like, oh yeah, he's been in those other movies. But I mean, he still did a great job. And I think one of the unique things about this particular relationship is the fact that he's very, like you said, he's very much in the film itself. He's very much a focus. He's a part of the entire plot. Like, the whole drive of it is well established early on. You realize this man's been gone for X amount of years, and everybody else has already pretty much called him dead. He's been right. Already, and everybody wants Laura to sign these papers so that everybody can move on with their life. But he actually isn't, spoiler alert, and they are, you know, working together to stop this mass evil from, you know, taking over the world.
Yeah, which she doesn't know at first. As far as anyone knows, he is totally fully gone. Until you, spoiler alert, encounter him later on, in the present day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's got a really nice balance between what you see of their early relationship, and then there's essentially this period of like, what, 14 years, 16 years, something, where he's not in her life and she's got to deal with the comments that people make about him, mm-hmm. and the comments they make about her and all of that. And, you know, she's like, she's a female boxer and she's a bike messenger and she doesn't want to have anything to do with the company. But then she ultimately gets looped into things and wants to find her father because she knows that what she's heard isn't the full story, and, you know, all this stuff that makes the story really rich to follow.
Yeah.
And then to have him still be alive and to have them reconnect in a certain way, you know, on this island and start working together, both as adults, it's a texture to the story that we haven't seen before. It's one of those things where, you know, to points that were made earlier, you know, you do want to have certain things that are familiar to the game fans, right, who are like, okay, you didn't screw that up, that actually looked pretty good compared to what I played however many years ago or yesterday. So, you know, check mark, you know, yeah, you referenced it and you didn't screw it up. But then also to have something new, to have something that I don't feel like this is all just a rehash of a game that I liked. Mm-hmm. You've got some new dynamic that we've never seen before that makes the movie its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really smart choice.
And aside from, like we said, aside from Dominic West and his role, you also have the introduction of Daniel Wu's character, Lu Ren, who is hilarious.
So good. So good in this movie.
And I guess, resident expert,
mm-hmm.
Is that character actually prevalent in the video games, or is that just something that was made up for the
film? Just made up for the film. He's not even in the game at all.
Okay, because he's hilarious in this movie, and he makes a lot of really fun comments that I thought were just, it helped move like a lot of what could have been monotony and really just monotone scenes.
Yeah.
He kind of helped move that along. And although he does trail off towards the tail end of the film as just somebody who's standing by, the first half of the film, he's pretty much really important and fun.
He has traits that other characters in the game have. Like, he's kind of like a bunch of characters like wrapped into one for the movie.
Hmm. How so?
Just like kind of like the realism, kind of just like Laura, you gotta be real here. Kind of like he's going along because he's getting paid in the movie, and there are characters in the game that are there for the same reason. They're being paid to be there. They don't believe anything about this island or anything about the story or anything like that. They're paid. Then you got some characters that are in the game for comedic relief, and obviously mm-hmm. he provided that. Like, he's just kind of a bunch of different elements wrapped into one.
And obviously, like we said, the main antagonist of this film is Walter Goggins himself, the man who scares everybody. He honestly is just so creepy. Like, he looks, like, I'm looking at his picture right now, and he's on some red carpet, and I'm scared because I'm looking at him. he's just, he's got this. Like,
this from the guy that loves horror movies.
I do,
and this has guy, seen all kinds of scary things.
But this guy legitimately scares me. He does. Walton looks like he can see into my soul.
Maybe he can.
Maybe he can. But I think that's kind of one of those things where you end up getting typecast for him. Probably so. I mean, obviously, like you said, he had a TV show that was pretty, may have been successful. I don't know if it was, where he played a army.
Yeah, like he was like a Navy SEAL or an Army Ranger, somebody captured behind enemy lines and tortured. And it was apparently raw. I haven't seen it, but it got good critical reviews.
He's got a very good, though, scary face. And so when it comes to movies...
Yeah, good choice. You know, having a bad guy that you don't have to do a lot makeup-wise to make him menacing and a threat.
And he was menacing from the get-go. Like, he was just really weird, just watching Laura sleeping and, like, making these really weird comments while looking off in the distance. Like, well, what do you do? Oh, I do whatever it takes to get the job done. And, like... That's not really a job title, but that's the worst job title I would want to hear from somebody. So
you just know that you're in a bad spot with that guy.
Yeah.
When you wake up from an already traumatic,
yeah,
experience
just from looking at him,
which is a little bit different from the game.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah. It in relation to how that's similar to the game, it's similar in name only. Pretty much. In the game, you see him. He's also... Oh, and the fact that he's the main antagonist. In the game, you meet him as somebody who's also stranded on the island. And he appears to be helpful. And is trying to kind of help you, you know, kind of get your wits about you after the shipwreck. Trying to figure out, you know, what's going on. And he, you know, he kind of explains a little bit about the island and stuff like that. You later find out that he is a leader of a cult of people who are made up of people who have also shipwrecked on the island, and they believe in the Queen Himiko. But he's not a archaeologist. He's not there as part of a secret shadow organization.
Interesting.
He's his own organization, and he's the leader of it. And yeah, but he's still equally menacing and creepy.
Yeah, because we haven't talked a whole lot about what brings people to this island.
No.
At least in the movie. I don't know how much it matches the game. I was surprised, actually. I've never played the 2013 game. I was very pleasantly surprised that they were leaning into this sort of like ancient or at least medieval Japanese type storyline where she was a Japanese queen.
Which was... actually pretty spot on for the game. Her story was changed a little bit in the movie. The game, I mean, how people got there, it's all the same thing. Nobody really goes there intentionally, which is why in the game and in the movie, people were calling Laura crazy for wanting to go there. The shipwreck scene was almost identical to the game. I think I mentioned to you guys after the movie, there were a couple times when it felt like I could almost see the hit X button like popping up, like so you can like grab onto something so you don't get washed away and stuff like that. That was pretty spot on. Arriving to the island is pretty spot on. Everybody there that was on the island in the game and in the movie were all there because they were shipwrecked there, and that's consistent across the board.
Yeah, like, during that boat scene, because, like, I was watching it, and, like, the second Laura gets, like, hit by a wave, I was like, wait a minute, I feel like I've either been here or done this before.
Right.
Like to the point where, like, I went home, and I started up the game from a new save.
Yeah.
And I played the opening, and I'm like, oh, yeah, that's, like, verbatim. I'm
basically like, what happens.
That was awesome.
It's funny. That's one of those things where it comes to when video game films like this, you tend to jump into those little mindsets. Like, seriously, I used to think that when I was watching Mortal Kombat, you had mentioned it earlier, and seeing like Liu Kang do those like really crazy kicks and whatnot, was weird. It's weird.
Well, there are certain things that the reason why the video game is popular is because there are elements that people really enjoy. So it's a smart play to take at least some of those elements and translate them to film, hopefully in a way that respectfully represents them, even if you change a few details.
Like
it's like, oh, this is something I loved, and here it is in another format, and I still love it.
Oh yeah, 100%. Like, there's another scene, and Spencer, I think you'll agree with me here too, is the airplane scene. She comes across the crashed airplane, which was also another almost shot for shot from the game. And again, you know, I feel, you know, wanting to hit the X button to grab onto, you know, the metal or grab onto the parachute as I'm falling out of the plane, mm-hmm. shot for shot. And I thought that was really well done. That's one of the things that hooked me into the movie. And I go, this is not a bad video game movie.
Was I the only one who got like the Lost World kind of vibes when that scene was happening? When she was on that little glass thing and it was about to
right,
break.
And it was
no,
gonna break.
But I get what you're saying.
Yeah, it was just, it was
little flashbacks of Julianne Moore.
Exactly. I'm like, get her,
as
Jeff Goldblum.
The Tyrannosaurs are pushing the trailers over the cliff.
Save her, Jeff Goldblum. Save her. But aside from, obviously, a lot of the characters, one of the main proponents of this film and one of the main driving forces is obviously the director. And it was interesting because I actually had to do some research because the name did not sound familiar to me at all.
And it's a very unique name.
Roar Uthog. First off, I don't know if I'd ever have the chutzpah to name my child Roar. Like, Roar, come over here. So, I mean, I could totally see that being turned into like whatever, like, oh, are you here, Roar? Roar! You know, anyway. Either way.
I mean, it might be pronounced differently. It looks like Roar. Scandinavian, so like maybe Roar. I don't
Roar.
Know.
But,
Norwegian.
Yeah, so yeah. But I mean, at this point, yeah. We should embrace him and they should
exactly.
play Katy Perry every time he walks into a room.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. Wow. Spencer, write an email. But the thing that I did notice was unique about this particular director, he actually directed 2015's The Wave. And I don't know, I believe it was you
oh,
and I who had
yeah.
talked about it. The Wave
that
is a Norwegian
good.
Film. It was pretty much set in this valley in Norway, somewhere in Norway, where he plays a seismologist who, there's a guy who plays a seismologist, and he's telling everybody that the dam isn't going to hold and that they need to do more things to kind of brace it. Nobody listens to him. And so all of a sudden this dam ends up breaking and there's a huge like just town.
Well, there's seismic activity. It's
yeah.
an earthquake situation. Mm, and okay. basically this town is in a fishbowl
yeah.
of mountains. So when the water breaks in, there's nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm. And it's a really good and exciting film. And I think one of the great things about it was its ability to translate like that terror and that feeling of like real dread, you know, of, you know, things like this happening.
Well, and showing you limited options. I think that one of the things that this film, the Tomb Raider film, did well that the others did not was showing a character who does not have access to anything that she wants mm-hmm. all the time. Because in the other films, they really leaned into how wealthy she was.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, as a result yeah. of her, you know, parentage and whatever. Like, she has access to private jets and private yachts and squirrel suits to fly through the air, you know, to escape the tower and fly onto a boat.
Right.
You know, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, there are things that are just not, like, it's not really a survival film. Mm-hmm. Or story, it's almost like a spy film.
Yeah, but
she's always prepared. She has weapons.
Yeah,
she
and,
has everything
and just
she
like
needs.
The top of the yeah. line, everything. In this one, she's got to use a cruddy parachute that she
yeah.
finds in a rusted out crashed plane. You know, she's using a bow and arrow at one point.
Yeah,
she doesn't just even when she's commissioning Lu Ren and his boat. To take her to the island, she doesn't flaunt a bunch of money around. And I mean, like, she essentially is like, you know, very limited means. And it really adds some authenticity to the story. And it makes it more of a survival narrative mm-hmm. than a spy film like the other ones kind of were.
And I think that another aspect to what you're saying is also the, in terms of its limited ability. Like, the fight sequences, I thought, in this film were so good because of the fact that she wasn't, like, this incredible, you know, decorated fighter or whatever who's done all these... I mean, in fact, it even establishes early on, she gets her butt whooped in the ring while sparring with somebody.
Right.
And I think that's really great to establish right before you begin a film like this to say, hey, by the way, she's not the greatest fighter. So this is a woman who's pretty much going off of her knowledge of survival and mm-hmm. how she can utilize what's around her to keep going
well,
forward.
Well, you see that she's passionate. Like, she's got the fire to be mm-hmm. a survivor, mm-hmm. but she's not the best combatant mm. that yeah. there is.
And I think that translates really well with like a lot of the scenes that happen after the fact. I mean, you get a lot of these fight sequences or you know, opportunities where you see her fighting or doing things, and it's like there's a rawness in what she's doing. It reminded me a lot of like seeing some of the scenes from the first season of Daredevil, where mm-hmm. a lot of those fight sequences, they seemed like they were legitimate, just like brawls, like they were going toe to toe, you know, fist for fist, and they were just, you know, beating each other senseless until somebody dropped. And that kind of seemed the way here, like her recognizing, oh yeah, wait, I, you know, when I was fighting in the ring, this would happen, so I'll do this. Like her honest dread and worry about how the fight ends, and you know, her actually killing somebody, and how it mm-hmm. kind of overtakes her mind. I really like the fact that the director decided to dive into that type of reality rather than say, oh yeah, after you're done killing somebody, you get up, shake off, and then you walk away.
Right,
like she was literally shaking right after that incident happens in
which
that scene
was amazing. Like
yeah,
for any film that has like fighting in it, it's just like, hey, let's stop and think about what you just did. I was like, what is happening? This is awesome.
this is awesome. She just killed somebody and is thinking about it right now.
I mean, because like you never see that really.
No, it's true. And that's why I say, like, for this particular film, I think on the cinematic side of things, when you have a character who is cognizant of his or her actions outside of the fantasy world that they're currently in, like if they're actually thinking about the realistic, you know, ramifications of like, oh my gosh, I just killed somebody, mm-hmm. as opposed to like to the, oh, I'm cool, just shoot somebody and then walk away, explosion behind me, sunglasses, thug life, whatever. You know, it's a lot.
I remember that from the first Tomb Raider.
Oh, same here.
Yeah. Angelina Jolie.
Exactly. And the mindset here is that this film actually, and I don't know if that's, like I said, thankfully we have our resident expert. I don't know if that's something that was unique to the actual video game as well. Like if it actually took that time and was like, oh, by the way, you know, you have to learn to, you know, put arm here, hit A, blah, 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 you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, she was, I mean, in the game, just like in the movie, she's, well, kind of different. She's a budding archaeologist. I mean, she's going to explore this island. She's not trained. She's not a combatant. She doesn't know how to use a gun, or you know, she knows bow and arrow, how to shoot a bow and arrow, because she's from a wealthy family, and that's what wealthy families do, is they learn, you know,
they
shoot bows and arrows at each other. But like, she doesn't have one. In fact, I think in the game she actually makes one. I can't remember, she either makes one or she takes one off of what appears to be a dead body, at which at that point she has no idea why there's a dead body on the island, but they have a bow and arrow that she uses.
I think one of the bigger questions with this particular director, like we were saying earlier about The Wave and the approach that Roar has when it came to creating that type of film, is creating that realistic one-to-one understanding of like, okay, this is what dread means to you, this is what dread means to you, this is what dread means to you, and in this instance, this is what dread means to this character in this situation, this is what dread means to this character in this situation, allowing the people, the audience, to really understand and really see with their own eyes, you know, how these people are processing from The Wave. I think that translates really well into this film, and I think another thing that really translates well is the ability to really create some really memorable scenes that have some of the most expertly blocked, you know, choreographed scenes that I've seen in a long time, especially not just for a video game movie, but for any action film. Yeah. I mean, and I think actually, Chad, you had mentioned this, and after you had said it, I began to think about it and actually looked it up, but I let you talk a little bit more about that.
There was a sequence that really, really impressed me in this film where she, after having escaped the clutches of, you know, this shadow government group that is finally trying to open the tomb of the dreaded Queen Himiko from, you know, ancient or feudal Japan, who had, in the story that you're told in the beginning, this queen was basically killing everybody just with a touch. And so a bunch of the I guess magistrates or warlords or whatever,
samurai,
banded together to capture her and take her to this island and imprison her there, with the implication that if you were to ever go and find her tomb and open it, sort of like mummy style, she would come back to life and kill the whole world. So it has this really fantastical context to it, and this group is there trying to find the tomb, and of course then at the prompting of a video that she received, a video message from her father from, you know, several years earlier, she goes to this island against his wishes in order to try to stop them. And so she's escaped their clutches at one point. She has her bow and arrow. She goes back and she infiltrates their camp. And mm-hmm. the way that the scene is blocked and choreographed was brilliant, because it's exactly what the director did in The Wave, in the sense of controlling the frame, the window that you're viewing the sequence through. You can, at some times, you can see what's over her shoulder behind her. You can very rarely see what she sees in the field. So your field of vision, your frame of reference is very limited, which mm-hmm. kind of puts you into that fight or flight mentality of like, oh, Laura, are you going to be okay? I can't see it. I can't see around you. Like, and she's, you know, ducking behind like utility cabinets and moving around pillars and, you know, going up and down. And there are still multiple active enemy combatants in the arena, if you will, and you can't even see the entire floor plan. You don't know the whole map. It felt very similar to being in a game,
mm-hmm.
And having a limited frame of reference. And, you know, I thought it was just really, really well done. The timing, the pacing, and the creative choice to kind of mimic the game mechanic
mm-hmm.
In a scene that really is heading toward the climax of the film.
And is so going back, obviously, that's why we have David. Is that scene like particularly unique to the film? To the game as well? Is that something that?
No, there's a very similar scene to where you're trying to escape the camp, and it's more of a it's stealth mission, if you will.
Mm.
You try not to be seen. You have the guards. It's at night, so it's a little bit different, but similar setting. You have the guards with flashlights. You have to avoid the light. I think you're armed with a bow and arrow at this point, because you're searching for your companions, your friends, because it's not just two people in the game. There's a whole crew that's with you. And so you're trying to find them and escape this camp at the same time. So yeah, it's a very similar fight scene.
And I, going back to what we were talking about with the based in realism type mindset, Chad was mentioning it earlier, and then obviously we're kind of diving into a few of the spoilers, but I don't want to give away too much, but I do like the way...
I don't either. It's special.
Yeah. I liked the way how this film keeps... It doesn't just promise realism in the first two-thirds of the film and mm-hmm. then change everything up at the very end to be like, oh, by the way, yeah, there's a witch at the bottom of this, you know, thing, and there's going to be some kind of brouhaha kind of stuff.
Right.
And the film continues its roots in realism all the way through till the end. Take that as you will. But I actually enjoyed it. I actually was satisfied knowing that this film didn't have to drive itself to a certain... to a certain destination of like, oh, so at the very end of this game, at the very end of this movie, you know, there's this really insane looking, you know, type of monster that appears and all this fighting and craziness.
Right, like the Cambodian statue that came to life in the second Tomb Raider movie. Yes. With Angelina Jolie.
Right.
She doesn't have to like punch a shark in the snout or do anything ridiculous to seem legit. Like, she's legit and... She earns, I guess, the distinction of being the hero.
Yeah.
You watch her do it.
Which is very, very in line with the game. She earns that. She's not by any means a hero going into this. She earns it. She teaches herself, you know, how to take care of herself and how to survive and do what needs to be done. And it's hard for her at first, just like in the movie. But, you know, as she goes on... It's getting easier and easier for her to just say, like, grit her teeth and do what needs to be done to survive.
Like I said, without going into spoilers and whatnot, I kind of want to start with Spencer. Spencer, was there any issue that you had with this film in terms of you know, whether if it's story, whether if it's character, whether if it's whatever, was there anything, without giving away, you know, really big information, what was one of the things that really stuck out to you that was just like, yeah, I could have done without?
Okay, well, it's like one of the bits of like breaking realism is that parachute that she just found in a plane. I'm like, no, that's not going to work. You can't just find a parachute that's been there for who knows how long and just... full, like, they check those things in real life like, to make sure they still work. So I was like, no, you're dead, like, right there.
You're dead.
So, but, like, other than that, like, going back to what you said about the end of the movie, seeking the realism, I wasn't expecting that. I was, like, expecting, like, once they were, like, down in there, I was like, okay, here's where everything just goes off the rails. But it didn't, and it kind of stayed, like, to the form that, of the rest of the movie, which was also super surprising, and I was very shocked by that as well.
Chad, I know you had a particular issue with one of the incidences that happens while they're in the caves that you were not a fan of.
I'm sure that I did. I don't remember now what it was.
Was it the floor?
The flooring?
Oh, it was the floor. Yeah, no. So, yeah. So, obviously, in a video game like this, you've got the narrative flow, and then you've got the side quests and the challenges that mm-hmm. you do as the controller of the main character. And for the most part, in the movie, the challenges, the puzzles, if you will, are pretty organically in there. There's one challenge in particular where the characters are in a very small, confined space, and the floor begins dropping out tile by tile beneath them until they can figure out the puzzle. That was the one scene that I really wanted to delete out of the film because it felt like, oh no, this was doing a great job of being a movie adaptation of a video game until this scene, which is a video game scene. It's a video game puzzle scene that you have to extra suspend your disbelief to the fact that so many of them don't end up following through the floor, even though most of the floor is gone, because it took them forever to figure out the puzzle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that, to me, that scene in particular was distracting because it didn't match the rest of it. Yes, it was, you know, one of the trials that, you know, you go through a series of trials to get to the place that you were trying to get to. That was the one that seemed the most gimmicky to me.
David?
So... I have two different opinions on the movie. As a movie as a whole, I think it's done really well. I like the, you know, you guys all touched on it already, the sticking with the realism as opposed to, like, one movie that comes to mind is the latest Indiana Jones with Shia LaBeouf. Mm-hmm. When it seems okay going on, and then at the very end, boom, it was aliens the whole time.
So bad.
And so in that, knowing what it was in the game and the fact that it started with realism in the movie and it stuck with realism to the end, I think it was done really well. I, on the other hand, I liked the story that was in the game, and I think that if they had started with that, then they could have pulled that off.
Hmm.
But it, going back to having to adapt something for the common denominator, I think this was a much more relatable, much more understanding story and plot than the game. I think this would hold people's attention better than the game would. So, 50-50.
I'm glad you mentioned the last Indiana Jones, because I was actually going to say that I would have taken this as the last Indiana Jones movie than the one with Shia LaBeouf in a heartbeat.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This, even with no Indiana Jones in this movie.
Exactly.
Yes.
Like, if there was even just a picture of Harrison Ford on the desk, I would have been fine to say it's connected.
It's the inspiration. It's the same universe.
Exactly. Because, like, I'm pretty sure you guys may have gotten the same sense, but I got so much love from this film for, like, the last Indiana Jones movies, like, all the Indiana Jones movies. Like, everything I was watching, I was like, yeah, I could totally see how this would fit in that universe. Like, my entire mindset at the time while watching the movie was, trying to figure out a way to make this fit into that universe.
Yeah.
Like, and because it all kind of started with the thought of like the three trials to get into the inner part of that cave, and I'm mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, penitent man will pass, and
right.
you know, all the, you know, it was really great to see that type of preparation being made for a film like this, rather than it just being like, oh, blow this up, let's walk through here or walk across there and we're good to go. There was care and there was thought brought into this, and I don't think we've seen a movie like this in a long time, and I'm even including the last Indiana Jones movie, like
sure.
a decent like archaeological type, you know, thrill seeking type of movie, something mm-hmm. like that. So I honestly, the only issue I did have was some of the CG work didn't really, you know, wasn't up to snuff for me. Like there was a scene where you're looking at Alicia Vikander from like atop the trees, and it's like going down and following her, and it totally looks kind of like a cutscene, like a video game cutscene. Right. And then it, like a branch goes across the screen and it transitions to regular film, and I'm like, yeah, I saw that. And it happened maybe a couple times, but I mean, that's movies for us, right? I mean, that's naturally the way the ball bounces most of the time with this.
And it's definitely better than the other Tomb Raider movies that had a lot more ridiculous stuff in them.
Yeah.
So, in conclusion, let's kind of go around the table and see, does it pass or fail for us, and how many monocles? And we will start with Spencer.
Okay.
Because you asked us to do this last time, because you said we said everything that you wanted to say.
That was about the rest of them.
So we're letting you go first.
Old news.
Okay. Anyway, no. I'll give this. It passes for me definitely. I'll give it about a 3 out of 5, because while it does like stumble a bit for like a regular movie, it does actually really fantastically for a video game movie. It's probably the best video game movie out there right now, which is saying a lot and also not saying
much at all.
Yeah.
What about you, David?
Yeah, I think 3 out of 5 is it's a good score. It passes for me. And yeah, similar. It's the best video game movie out there, but the bar is not very high. So it's a good movie on its own, though.
Chad?
I would definitely say it passes for me. I would give it probably a 4 out of 5 because I don't really have... It didn't feel most of the time like a video game adaptation. I really was kind of in a mood, Eddie, like you were just mentioning. It was sort of like, oh, this could work as like a modern day Indiana Jones mm-hmm. type movie.
Yeah.
And I loved the original 3 Indiana Jones movies. Still love. it's not a past tense verb. I still actively love them. They're great. And yeah, so I think that there are definitely some things that could have been done better. That's true of any movie, but yeah. I thought that it was better coming out of the movie than I expected to feel about it going into it. I felt better about the movie having seen it.
I have to agree. I think it passes for me. And I think going into the film, a lot of what my fears were settled and you know removed instantaneously as soon as the film started getting into gear. And I found myself really enjoying it. I loved the way I felt coming out of this film as opposed to how I felt when I watched the last Indiana Jones movie. So that says a lot in itself. Or, like Spencer said, it may not say much at all about the film. In terms of how many monocles, I'm going to give it 3.5 out of 5. I really like the story. I really like the drive of where the character went and how the director took the approach of creating it based in realism as opposed to creating it based in fantasy. Obviously, there's a lot that was taken liberty with when it came to the source material. But when it comes to video game movies, bottom line, I mean, you either make a great movie or you make an okay video game adaptation or however. And I think in this case, it kind of toes that line between those two of making a decent video game adaptation and a decent movie by itself, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So
you can't necessarily serve both camps
exactly
in full all the time.
And so, yeah, that about wraps up our conversation on Tomb Raider. Again, if you have any thoughts on this, or if you've seen the film and you totally disagree with us, or you want our resident video game expert's phone number to ask him the questions directly, let us know in the comments on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosspersons.
David Webb, ladies and gentlemen.
I go by Corey Vincent. So yeah, you can look him up on social media.
We'll take a picture of his business card and post it on Facebook. Or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/philosophy101. Before we go, there is a piece of news that we actually wanted to talk about because of the fact that I think this table alone has probably some of the most diehard Marvel fans that I know of, and you cannot go an opportunity of, oh, I already see David Webb rolling up his sleeves. Look at that. That's right. We are going to talk real quick about the Infinity War trailer, the most recent one that dropped, and it is... it's glorious, to say the least. There's so much that's happening in this trailer. You got everything from the introduction of Doctor Strange, Benedict Cumberbatch's Doctor Strange, and Spider-Man, played by Tom Holland, to even the interaction, the famed interaction that everybody had been dreaming of and hoping of between Tony Stark, Star-Lord, and Drax, and Spider-Man, which that's a unique kind of roundtable discussion all on its own. But I think the first thing to really just kind of, because I know I'm kind of holding back the gates here for Chad and David and possibly
everybody's
Spencer.
Leaning forward like stop talking.
So I'm gonna go ahead and release the hounds and go ahead and let Chad gush about this. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, yeah, the delight that I feel on the inside, it's hard to put into words. Because, number one, I'm a big fan of these characters. I'm a big fan and have been since way before the movies were ever even thought about. At least this iteration of movies was ever even thought about. I'm also a big fan of seeing such an ambitious, ridiculous plan actually come together and work to conceive of translating. I mean, we talked a lot in this episode about how do you translate video game mechanics to a movie experience? How do you translate the comic book serialized storytelling experience to movies? Even when you do have franchises like, you know, say Star Wars, where you've got multiple movies in sequence, and you can even tell stories before or after the sequence that you're familiar with or that kicked it off. Here you've got actually multiple franchises that all need to integrate together in a certain way, and it easily could have flopped. It easily could have failed. Because that's, I mean, that's bonkers crazy as a vision statement for what you're going to do with, you know, with any new project. Obviously, they had established characters that some people are big fans of, but most of the mainstream audience didn't know, like, Doctor Who,
right?
You know, like Doctor, yeah. Not Doctor Who.
Yeah,
that was a bad
Doctor
example.
Who.
That was a bad example. Doctor Strange, who's that? They might know Spider-Man. They might know the Hulk.
Yeah.
When it came out, they probably did not know Iron Man. You know, and that's what they used to kick the whole thing off. I mean, the whole thing start to finish. I mean, it's not finished, but this big mega phase is finishing out. For it to have worked as well as it has is tremendous. And to see this glimmer of what the fully integrated, you know, MCU culminating moment is starting to look like, it's really satisfying.
Oh, yeah.
Spence, because we're going to start around this table, what are some of the highlights that you remember out of this trailer that you're really looking forward to? You really actually want to kind of see fleshed out a little bit more, maybe know a little bit more info about?
Whenever I watch these trailers, I'm constantly wondering, how in the world are you going to balance all these personalities? Because there's a lot of big personalities in, like, all these different, like, movie groups, and they're all being thrusted together. And I'm like, I can't, like, conceptualize how that's going to work. I would have a feeling that they're going to have a good plan for that because their last two movies have been pretty, like, out of this world. So I'd be surprised if they misstep there because this is such a slam dunk move for them. Like, because they've been building to this for 10 years. Like, this is the one they have to get right.
Yeah.
Also, I'm glad we're going back to Wakanda so quickly. Now, that's going to be fun.
Hallelujah for that.
Especially
that is.
Now that there's a giant dome shield around Wakanda in one scene, it looks like, which is interesting.
It's probably like the defensive barrier or something that they have set up.
You know, when you've got an intergalactic warlord wanting to kill everybody coming to Earth, you might put that up.
You know, yeah,
if you can.
You think about flipping that switch.
Yeah, exactly. That might come standard with those kinds of threats. David, what are some of the things that you're looking forward to or things that stood out to you?
So much. We got another hour, right?
He's got a list, ladies and gentlemen.
So real quick, you mentioned it, but the interaction between Star-Lord and Iron Man. I've read comics where you have Iron Man partnering with the Guardians of the Galaxy. So seeing that on screen and just that little bit of interaction between the big ego of Star-Lord and the big ego of Tony Stark is, I think, going to be a hilarious outplay on the screen. Also, seeing Peter Parker and Spider-Man still just kind of in awe of the fact that he is among these people. I mean, the whole scene of like, oh, hi, I'm Peter Parker. I'm Doctor Strange. Oh, we're using our made-up names.
Yeah.
Then I'm Spider-Man. Like, it's just such a good, like, it's placed so well into what we've seen Spider-Man so far in this, you know, iteration. God, just, you know, going back to Wakanda, seeing the whole team together there, seeing the Hulkbuster, but realizing that, wait a minute, Iron Man is on a different location, so who's in the Hulkbuster? Is anybody in the Hulkbuster? Like, there's so much. I'm just so excited.
The Hulk is in the Hulkbuster. I mean, come on. Well, it doesn't get more exciting than like, wait, hold on.
Did you guys hear that there was a leak that it's been confirmed from Target? They released a toy, and the toy is the action figure of the Hulkbuster, and it's from, you know, Infinity War, and on the packaging it says Hulk/Hulkbuster.
Yeah.
So it's been confirmed, but like, it's just so cool to see that.
And it's going to be just as cool knowing it or not knowing it going in. It's going to be just as cool to see.
Well, it kind of goes back to a line that he has in an earlier movie where he says that he's talking to Tony Stark and he's like, when you go out there, you have armor, you have something protecting you. I have nothing. It's just my bare skin out there. And now he's going up against, you know, this intergalactic warlord, and now he actually has armor to protect him, which I think it's kind of a cool like parallel.
Jed?
So I loved it from the first like voiceover words. They have Gamora, Zoe Saldana's character from Guardians of the Galaxy, who was adopted / basically just abducted from her home world when Thanos came and destroyed it. He saved her and then trained her along with Nebula and others to basically be warriors. And so the entire trailer starts with her beginning to relay some of her experience in his quote-unquote family.
Yeah.
Which is brilliant because, whenever you think of big superhero films, you know, you've got absolutely you want to build to the big bad guy. And we've known for a long time that he's the big bad guy that we've been building toward. But to start this trailer with somebody who has more intimate knowledge, quote-unquote familial knowledge, of how he behaves behind closed doors, and you have that character on your side, like prepping you and cautioning you about what's about to go down, I thought that was incredible. Loved the music that kept like the heartbeat pumping throughout the trailer. Yeah. Wakanda, 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 Wakanda forever. Okoye is my jam, and I cannot wait to see her. I want her to fight Proxima Midnight. I don't know if it's going to happen.
Yeah.
But why not? You still have time, Marvel. Reshoot that if you need to. No, I love the fact that they moved up the date of the movie altogether.
Like, what?
There's so much to enjoy and appreciate without ever even having seen the movie yet.
Yeah. Completely. I think one of the things, because we're running out of time, one of the things I just really wanted to hit on was the fact that we're getting a little bit more glimpses of the actual Black Order. You know, we're seeing, you know, Ebony Maw and Proxima Midnight, and we're actually seeing them, like, in the flesh. Like, there's a quick glance.
Yeah, we've only seen the statues so far.
Exactly.
from
D23, but there's a scene where they're surrounding Loki and all of them are there, and it looks really cool, and you see like Ebony Maw, like, you know, torturing Doctor Strange, and there's so much to look forward to, because in all previous iterations, most other aliens don't really, they're usually cannon fodder. They're like, you know, just people who are there an instant and gone the next.
Right.
But these individuals look to bring destruction and mayhem to wherever they lay their hands to, and because they work for the Mad Titan himself, it looks like they are pretty formidable foes.
Yeah.
So I'm actually anxious to see something like this happen, where the likeliness of some of the most beloved characters we've known in Marvel for the last, what, 10 years at least, may actually perish in this event. So,
oh, for sure, there several of them are not going to make it.
Yeah. So, I mean, not that I'm looking forward to anybody dying. I'm not saying that.
Because, no, like, you don't normally with superhero movies, you go into it and like you're like, oh, well, they can't die in this movie, but they can die in this movie.
That's what's exciting.
They
can die in this movie.
And you don't control who, which ones do or don't. Yeah. Like, you don't actually know.
There's no voting on this one.
Presumably, Peter Parker should make it out alive because they have another Spider-Man movie on the docket.
Right.
However, the way that the entire storyline works, that might not even hold true, you know, because of what some of these Infinity Stones can do.
Plus the fact that he keeps talking about spoilers and whatnot in press interviews. I'm pretty sure they're thinking, maybe we should kill him in Infinity War. And, you know, just...
Let's recast another Spider-Man.
All right, Miles Morales, you're on.
Here we go.
Oh, that would be so cool.
But, yeah, I'm looking forward to this film. We all are looking forward to this film. And, Marvel cannot get here soon enough. Before we go, we want to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases. You got Isle of the Dogs, Sherlock Gnomes, and Pacific Rim Uprising. Chad is shaking his head on Sherlock Gnomes. I think he wants to see it.
Nope.
So,
not even a little.
But no, we had a great conversation here, and I want to thank everybody here at the table for being a part of that, especially Mr. David Webb, resident video game expert. Thank you for making the time to be with us, man.
Thanks for having us, having me.
There's several of you?
Yeah. I got a lot of things, this is a lot of things going on right now.
Split. David, where can people find you and check out your show?
So you can find me on the Video Game Bang podcast. We are everywhere you can listen to podcasts. Just search for us, including Spotify as of recently. Then you can find me on Twitter at @RealDavidWeb, Instagram at @TheRealDavidWeb. And then, of course, just Video Game Bang on Twitter at Video Game Bang.
Cool. Well, like I said, this is a great conversation, and I can't wait to see what else is in store in terms of the video game franchise. And hopefully this kind of brings to the table the idea that you can have a great video game and still have it rooted in realism, to where people don't need to know that it's based off a video game to enjoy it. So here's to hoping, right? But again, great conversation. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.